Hey, y'all, and welcome back to Uplift Fit Nutrition Radio. I'm your host, Lacey Dunn, registered dietitian, here to spread the scientific knowledge in the world of fitness and nutrition. I'm so excited about today's episode, so make sure you listen in and get ready to learn. Hey guys, welcome back to Uplift Fit Nutrition Radio. Today I have Maria Claps. I'm so excited to have her on today. She is what I would call an expert or guru in perimenopause and menopause and women's hormones. So I'm really excited to have her on, guys. She has a wealth of knowledge. I'm so thankful for everything that you do, everything that you share on a day-to-day basis on social media. So thank you for being a voice for science and coming on my podcast. I greatly appreciate it.
Oh, you're so sweet. I am so excited to be here. You may regret that you asked me because once you get me talking about hormones and changes in perimenopause, I am hard to shut up. But thanks, Lacey. I'm super looking forward to this.
You're so welcome. That's what you call passion, for sure. Mm-hmm. When you're passionate about something, you just want to voice it to the world. So that's incredible.
Thank you.
So can you tell my listeners a little bit about who you are, your background, what got you so passionate about women's hormones?
Certainly. Okay, so I'm a health coach and a functional diagnostic nutrition practitioner, quite a mouthful. And when I was in my early 40s, I was going through perimenopause. I didn't quite know at the time what was happening, but there were palpable changes in my mood, in my body. And I finally realized, probably from speaking to my mother, we tend to get our wisdom from our elders, right? And I finally realized that it was perimenopause. So I sought out the help of a very well-known doctor in New York City because I was always kind of holistically oriented. And I just knew that the doctors in my town were probably just going to write a prescription for me. And while I'm not opposed to that idea at all, it wasn't the first thing I wanted to go to. So I sought out a doctor with multi-published, YouTube, big center on Park Avenue in New York City. And I have previously labeled the visit an epic fail, but I'm softening on that. Yeah, it was a near epic fail in that it just really didn't help me. Ran so many tests. There was like no coaching involved. It was like, take this, take that. Let's do 50,000 IU of vitamin D a week, but still a very high dose. He gave me some hormones to try, which you know from following me, I am certainly not categorically against, but it was just so much here, do this, do this, do that, with no education in what's really going on and how to, you know, advocate for myself. So it was at that point that I said, I am going back to school on everything hormones. Everything hormones and perimenopause and menopause. And that's when I started my educational journey at a health coaching school and sought out mentorship. And I've done, you know, courses designated just for physicians. I've done the menopause method course. And I actually still mentor with doctors that have been in the clinical trenches for decades on everything hormones.
So well, that's such a testimony for going through struggles and being able to come out of it and help others. There's so much power in that and being able to be empathetic with what people have gone through.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So I'm so sorry you've had to go through that. I know for me, I've had my own troubles with doctors and ultimately it just makes us better people.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I don't regret it at all. It just forms the basis of who I am today, or forms a large part of the basis of who I am and how I communicate with people and how I see things. So yeah, it was a great experience. I think it's, you know, I'm not a super, you know, mindset type of a person, although I realize the value and I really value people who can bring that mindset into the nutrition and health space. But it really is true that you sometimes the only way out is through the situation. And that's, so I give thanks for that. Just like I give thanks for the first time I failed my FDN examination. I was like, oh, I failed. But I learned so much more from failing than I did from passing the first time. And I just equate that to going through struggles as well.
That's awesome. I've heard a lot about the FDN. Did you like it?
I loved it. It was amazing. It was hard. They don't pass everyone. I didn't pass the first time. But I, like I said, I learned a tremendous amount by not passing. And we learn a tremendous amount from our struggles.
Agreed. And also when it comes down to testing too, there's test anxiety, there's trickery. So it's always like you can know the information and then just get to the test and just be like, meh, like.
True.
Out the window because I'm stressed.
Yes, yes.
So awesome. Okay, so let's talk about perimenopause. Can you explain to my listeners what exactly happens during menopause and how hormones and the female metabolism changes?
Sure. So perimenopause is often referred to in the scientific literature as the menopausal transition. And if we hearken back to geometry, peri means around, right? So it's around the time of menopause. Menopause is on average for Western women about age 51, okay? Normal is kind of 45 to 55, right? So prior to that time, and that your best guess as to when you will be fully menopausal, and let me establish this right up at the beginning. Menopause is absence of a period for 12 months. It's not your FSH level. It's not your estradiol level. It's not your hormone level. It's absence of a period for 12 months. Okay. So if you, but it's not just it's not just like, okay, you know, you're going along, you know, with most women in their 20s, 30s, early 40s have predictable cycles. That's if they don't have PCOS or stress or hypothalamic amenorrhea. They have predictable cycles. And then at some point, it's usually the 40s, ovulation tends to sputter. And so why is that important? Okay. That's important because if we don't ovulate, we don't create progesterone. And so what's funny is, and that's the kind of like the beginning of the hormone cascade and how our body is changing. And that's very much a hallmark of perimenopause is a lack of ovulation. So for women that are really tuned into their body, maybe they do fertility charting or they track ovulation, they will, you know, kind of see and feel those changes. I didn't do that. And it's just interesting. You can menstruate, but it doesn't mean you ovulate. So you can menstruate without ovulation. So women can be menstruating semi-regularly and still be perimenopausal. But it's when that menstruation starts to get irregular, like, oh, I skipped a month. And so now you've got a woman who's like 43. I skipped a month or two. And what's the first thing she thinks, Lacey, if she skipped a period at that age?
Oh, I'm in perimenopause, or it's menopause time.
What she thinks is, oh my God, am I pregnant?
Really? Okay.
Yeah, because you know, she's like, again, her periods have been regular her whole life. And now she's like, oh my gosh, am I going to have this? Am I pregnant? Because a period, you know, just kind of disappeared. But another thing that happens in perimenopause is, so instead of your periods coming every 28, 26, 30 days or so, they start coming like every 21 days or 20 days or 18 days. So they get that cycle length either gets longer apart or closer together or a combination of the two until it, and this is what happens for most women. Very few women have regular 28-day periods and then boom, they stop. So there's this change in the period. So that to me is like the kind of clarion sign of perimenopause, but there are other signs as well. And those other signs are you're gaining weight, not sleeping well, low libido, low motivation. So that's sort of like the hormonal environment of perimenopause.
So what essentially happens to create the changes in the mood and the weight?
Super interesting. So mood's going to be a little bit easier to answer. So what happens is, so progesterone is dropping in perimenopause. Estrogen is fluctuating, but it's fluctuating for most women. And realize when I speak, I'm saying this is most women. Of course, we have to account for individualities amongst each different woman. But so progesterone has dropped. Estrogen is fluctuating, but it's typically fluctuating at a lower level. So in essence, Both progesterone and estrogen are kind of on their way out. So why this affects mood, why this affects libido is because, you know, most of us think of our hormones as, you know, the things that create, you know, women out of girls, that give the secondary sex characteristics, the breasts and the hips and, you know, sexual maturation. But estrogen has hundreds of jobs in the body. And one of those, I mean, it controls the immune system. It interfaces with our neurotransmitters. So when those hormones are dropping, estrogen specifically, it can pull down serotonin. It can interfere with dopamine. And, you know, women can feel moody from that. Some women feel a sense of anxiety when their progesterone has dropped off as well. So there are big issues with hormone changes. Again, it's mood and motivation, libido or one of them. Now, weight, that is a bit of a more of a complex thing. I feel like we need to kind of go into the adrenal hormones to discuss the weight changes. So adrenal hormones, you know, women will make some progesterone, some estrogen out of their adrenals as they move into menopause. Like we, during that menopausal transition, we're going to lean on our adrenal hormones more. I don't necessarily believe in adrenal fatigue. I feel that that's kind of bandied about very, very freely. There is adrenal dysregulation. Maybe I'm just splitting hairs with the words, but we don't say pancreatic fatigue.
I'm so with you there.
Yes, or thymus gland fatigue, or, you know, I don't think we say cardiac fatigue. We might. I'm not sure about that. So there is a certain amount of dysregulation, and that is, that's due to, you know, us leading a go, 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 stressful lifestyle, never taking time for ourselves. And, you know, adrenals help to buffer and modulate stress in our life. And if we're always calling upon them, then, you know, they're, I don't want to say fatigued, but there is a certain amount of dysregulation there. You know, we're meant to have short stressful periods and then to have it, you know, kind of stop mm-hmm. and return to like this nice homeostasis. But, you know, and it's not just psychological stress on the adrenal glands, it's physiological stress. So if you don't have balanced blood sugar, if you are just like snacking all day or eating like too many carbohydrates, sugary foods, you're going to increase your cortisol on that alone, and you're going to have problems with hormone balance. So that could be the weight thing. Now, another issue with weight in perimenopause, again, is when our estrogen declines, and this is one thing I don't see a lot of people speaking about, when our estrogen declines, we cannot handle glucose anymore. Well, I don't want to say fully anymore. Perimenopausal and menopausal women, if they want to be healthy, they need to reassess what they're eating. And a majority of them, and again, realize this is general information. This is not super specific. It's different for each woman. But, you may need to say, take your carbohydrates from 200 or 300 a day, which I hear that you probably would be, at least you would be better to tell me on this. The average American eats about 300 grams of carbs. I think that's super high.
Way too high for what I work with.
Yes, but do you think that that's the average, like American?
No way that is average for a woman.
Well, so, right. It's certainly not optimal. I mean, I think even on my high carb days, I eat about 150. But anyway, long story short is that, you know, you, say if you're eating 150 grams of carbs a day, I'm not a macro counter. I mean, I think I just don't like it. I admire the people who can do that. It's just not me. But, and I think it's definitely worthwhile at times to do that for sure, to see where you are. But so if you are eating, say, 150 and you're 45 and painting a picture for you and you're gaining weight, you might need to drop down to 75. And again, just throwing numbers out there, but that's because you're low estrogen. Estrogen makes us sensitive to insulin. When you lose estradiol, the main female estrogen, you lose a certain degree of sensitivity to insulin. When you eat your carbs, and again, I'm not bashing carbs. I like them. I wish I could eat a heck of a lot more than I do. And I still do eat some, but I have dropped them because I don't want to put on that weight. So, you know, things that are healthy in the paleo blogosphere is like the sweet potatoes and the winter squash. Still a lot of carbohydrate for menopausal women, depending on, you know, what your total intake is for the day. So that's another thing that can make women gain weight as they go through perimenopause, is that dropping of that estrogen.
Yeah, I definitely see that hands down in my clients. And the struggle too is then with that reduction in insulin sensitivity and then the low progesterone, then you have the anxiety of the mood swings, you have the cortisol swings, and it just becomes kind of like fire all together. The person is craving more carbs, is trying to get more serotonin, and then they're eating them and they're gaining weight and they're like, I don't know what's happening. They're not feeling good. And it just becomes kind of like a vicious storm for weight gain.
It's absolutely very challenging. So, you know, whereas I can have women like, you know, talk to them and coach them on cutting their carbohydrates and give meal ideas and things like that, there's just that, you know, insatiable desire, and there's that connection with the neurotransmitters. And then we add in there, you know, some gut dysregulation, candida, which can make us crave even more carbohydrates. Unfortunately, sometimes, Lacey, I feel like people think that I create like a really dire picture of midlife, but like the gut ages like any other organ. And, you know, older women tend to have more dysbiotic guts than women in their 20s and 30s. And interestingly enough, I'm going to tie it back to estrogen. Lack of estrogen can decrease gut health. It can actually decrease methylation. So it's a challenge. It's a challenge worth taking, but these are the changes that happen in the body.
Yeah. And then of course, I know you've talked about it a lot, the changes in the vaginal microbiome that happen, increased risk for bacterial and yeast infections. And I kid you not, those can be such a demon for how you feel on a day-to-day basis in your lady region, as well as sex drive. So
absolutely. Like, who wants to have sex if it hurts?
Right?
It's supposed to feel good. It's supposed to like kind of propagate the species and the, you know, how we do that. But yeah, no, the vagina actually changes tremendously. And I always like to say that, and it's hugely, hugely underreported. Women don't really talk to their physicians about this because A, they're embarrassed, and B, they think it's just a normal part of aging. So it can absolutely be handled, reversed. So,
well, that's good to hear. All you women, if you're in perimenopause, it may be common, but it doesn't make it normal. So let's talk about common mistakes that you see in women that are trying to alleviate their perimenopause symptoms, whether that be diet, nutrition, which is diets, supplementation, lifestyle factors. What are the common mistakes that you most likely see?
Sure. So I guess the biggest one, because it's the most accessible, is that they kind of they calorie restrict and increase like intense exercise. So like the HIIT and the cardio and things like that. So basically, again, I'm going to paint this picture of a typical perimenopausal woman, 43, 45, 47, putting on weight, unhappy, doesn't feel good about herself, doesn't feel sexy. So she wants to lose weight. Again, it's in the national consciousness. We all think of cutting calories and exercising more, which is not necessarily bad advice. It depends on the woman, right? I mean, some of us may need to cut calories, but most of the times what we need to focus on is nutrient density, getting really nutrient dense food, and exercising according to our adrenal gland health. And I saw someone say this, and also if we're not sleeping, caloric restriction plus intense exercise can be really harmful. I saw someone say, like, waking up at 5 a.m., which a lot of my clients do, to exercise like an Orange Theory or an intense exercise, body pump, boot camp, whatever. You know, you got those early morning boot camps, right? After sleeping for like waking up at 5 a.m. after sleeping for 4 hours is like stepping over $100 bills to pick up nickels. It's just wrong.
Yeah. So. I've been on so many different, talked to so many people on different podcasts and talking about like Orange Theory, CrossFit. I'm like, I swear to you, Orange Theory, CrossFit, all these high intensity type of workout programs are giving me clients because they were giving these clients adrenal problems.
Interesting. Yeah. And it's, you know, I think that there might be a time and a place for that, but it's the things that we put into place to make us healthy, the things that we don't really want to do, which is just the sleep and the winding down at night and
slothing.
Just, what's that?
Slothing. That's what I call it.
Slothing. Okay. Slothing. You know, getting really good nutritious food, like, you know, not just eating, you know, eating like a bird, just like salads all day. And so I love salad, but you know, it's not enough. It's not enough nutrition for you. So, and not sleeping and, you know, like running junior everywhere and not taking time for yourself. Like perimenopause requires, and menopause requires a meticulous level of nutrition and self-care. There's just no other way around it.
I'm glad you said that. It's so important. So we discussed about carbohydrate changes. Always need to focus on quality of fats because that can heavily influence your hormones. So you guys make sure you're focusing on those omega-3 fats, reducing those processed vegetable oils, a lot of olive oil, avocado, chia seeds, flaxseed, salmon, things like that. But let's talk about the supplements because I kid you not, that's the first thing everybody runs to when they start having these perimenopause symptoms. It's not about diet. It's all about supplementation. People go run to their nearest store and grab a supplement. So let's chat about those supplements because I kid you not, I always have people start on DIM and it makes me go insane.
Yeah, DIM is generally not good for perimenopause. It's usually completely contraindicated for menopausal women. And we see like lots of supplements, not just DIM, but like combination supplements that have DIM in them that are like kind of directed towards healthy estrogen balance. Well, you can't really use it unless you know what your estrogen balance is. And you don't really know that unless you test. So yeah, I'm not a big fan of people just randomly using DIM at all. You know, some women like will turn to, what is it? Evening primrose oil. I use supplements readily. I just think that they need to be used carefully and for perhaps some of them short periods of time. Like I am completely against anyone using any adrenal supplement long-term, you know, 3 months, 6 months, you know, shift the body in a certain metabolic direction. But adrenal health as relates to menopause, perimenopause, it's like 95% a lifestyle fix. It's getting bed. It's getting sun in the morning. It's, you know, it's enforcing borders. It's figuring out like why the body is prefer, you know, is secreting so much cortisol or not enough. We can absolutely use supplements. And sometimes I, even for low cortisol, like have clients go to a medical doctor and use Cortef, which is hydrocortisone. It absolutely has a place, but it's mostly a lifestyle thing. So for menopause in general, perimenopause, you know, what other supplements do you see people going towards?
A lot of the blends, but I would say I'm a huge fan of things like adaptogens. So we're looking at holy basil, ashwagandha, rhodiola. I really love black cohosh for hot flashes. I'm all about trying to not use supplements if needed, but I do know some can be extremely powerful for helping with symptom management.
Yeah. So the approach I take, sure. I'm not anti-symptom management at all. I even recently used like 2 or 3 days of ibuprofen for myself. But I think where we go wrong in perimenopause and especially menopause is looking at either black cohosh or hormone replacement therapy as symptom management instead of really addressing quality of life and having your health span match your lifespan. So for instance, I am actually not a big fan of black cohosh, and I'm going to tell you why. I'm not against it. I love herbal medicine in general. I love it more for adrenal health than anything else. I love holy basil too. I drink it in tea all the time. But the reason why I'm not a fan of herbs for menopause and black cohosh is because it takes the focus off on what will really, really move the needle and create a healthier woman versus just managing symptoms. And to me, that's what black cohosh does. Yes, it may help with hot flashes, but hot flashes are related to osteoporosis. And black cohosh ain't going to help your osteoporosis. So
that is very true.
Yeah.
Vitamin D, calcium, proper diet, weight training, that will help your osteoporosis. Of course,
and
estrogen up. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm glad you said that. So recap, you guys, supplements can help, but they will not get rid of the underlying issue there for sure. And they can cover up what could else be potentially wrong.
Yeah, supplements could be like a form of green allopathic medicine if we treat them just like, oh, let me just take this for that. I mean, I love supplements and I'm taking, you know, quite a lot now myself, but very targeted for different things, so things for my thyroid, because you know what? Bottom line is, you know, in this case, your thyroid needs selenium, your thyroid needs iodine to make its hormones. And if you don't give it that, and I don't know that I'm getting that in my food right now, then we need a little boost. So supplements are great, but just make sure that you're doing all of the other things that support a healthy lifestyle.
I agree. And I kid you not, a lot of people are very much deficient in micronutrients, specifically vitamin D. I swear like 70% of the population is vitamin D deficient. It does not matter if you get a lot of sun, a lot of people are deficient. So sometimes supplements are a must.
Totally. And interestingly enough, vitamin D is really hard to get from food.
It is.
So, I mean, if you can get it from the sun, great. But if you can't, or if you have that, you know, there's a vitamin D receptor gene that some people just don't make good vitamin D from the sun, then yeah, you need to supplement.
Yeah, that's me. That's me for sure. Okay, oh, so wow. We went over common mistakes. What are your favorite approaches to help with managing perimenopause in a holistic way? So you talked about those lifestyle changes. You talked about diet. So in regards to those lifestyle changes, what are your top recommendations? Is it light therapy? Is it going on walks? What are your best management activities?
To manage the symptoms?
To manage perimenopause in general.
Okay. So I would say that it's a really good idea to get tested. You know, hormones are fluctuating from day to day, sometimes from hour to hour. That doesn't mean that testing is not helpful. So get tested. If anything, to look and see what the status of the adrenal glands are and to support those. So testing is super important. One of the things I absolutely love, and I recommend this for all of my clients with low cortisol, is to get some sunlight within, if you can. I can only do this really in the late spring and summer, is to get some sunlight within a half hour of waking up. Super important. Helps to set the circadian rhythm. That actually will help you sleep better at night. You get that sunlight in the morning. Mm-hmm. Absolutely some kind of restorative exercise. So walking, yoga, if you can, you know, I'm not anti more intense exercise. It's really based on the woman, right? So if you can do weight training, you know, because osteoporosis, it's a big deal. It's not a sexy topic. There's very little information on it. It proceeds very silently for women. And then all of a sudden she's got a hip fracture or, you know, has broken a bone. So weightlifting is incredibly important for your bones and helps with weight maintenance as well. So
I'm a huge fan of weight training, obviously. Really, really love it. Okay. So glad you mentioned everything with the light. Also a big fan for circadian rhythms, blue light blocking glasses, which I know I have to wear at night or my sleep is janked up. So huge fan of that.
Yeah, I like them too. These are blue blockers. I have them on sometimes for computer work during the day. But I'll tell you one thing is I don't love blue blockers. If they kind of give women permission to stay on the phone and computer, like say 2 hours before bed, I think you should put the blue blockers away, or not necessarily put the blue blockers away, but put the computer and the phone down and tend to your needs. Like don't stay on just because you have blue blockers. If you have to, you know, if you're having a business call with someone in the Pacific, then, you know, South Pacific, then yeah, blue blockers are great, but don't you be scrolling Instagram at 10 o'clock at night because you've got blue blockers on.
Yeah, people run to social media and the internet and TV and all because it creates a dopamine response.
Yes. Yes.
And people want more and more and more of it. Well, just try and get that dopamine another way.
Yes.
Go grab your husband, have sex or something.
Yes. Give someone a hug.
Yeah, that would be a better way.
No, sex is bad.
So yeah, there's a lot of different things we can do. And then I think also with the blue light, some people will wear them all day, like starting in the morning all the way to the night. And then you're creating even more dysregulation in your circadian rhythms. I was just reading a paper the other day on how if you have them all day, then you're creating even more havoc.
Yes. And similarly, so I do wear, these are blue blockers, but when I go outside, like I just took a walk in the bright sunshine before this, I will take these off. And similarly, you know, you don't want to wear sunglasses all day if you're out in the sun. You want to have periods of exposure to sunlight. You know, we never want to look directly at the sun for our retina's sake, but we want to be in sun without blue blockers. And you know what? For talking about vitamin D, going back to that, we want to be in sun for, I don't know, 15, 20, 25 minutes without any sunblock as well. So there's a place for that.
Yeah, I love that. I just told one of my clients yesterday, I was like, 15 minutes a day, I want you in the sun. I want you relaxing, going on a walk, and I want you singing like Beyonce, because that can help with your cortisol as well.
And mood and neurotransmitters. Yes, I love it. That's great advice.
Okay, so can you talk a little bit about bioidentical hormone replacement therapy? I know it's something that is very much people teeter-totter about talking it, but I would love to get your thoughts on bioidenticals.
We could probably do a 2-hour podcast on that. I kid you not, but I'll try to be concise here. So yeah, I'm a big fan of bioidentical hormone replacement therapy. I educate women on it. I cannot write a prescription. Again, I like when we were talking about herbs or hormone therapy. Hormone therapy is for symptom alleviation. You get the right dose of estrogen, you've got no more hot flashes. You get the right dose of estrogen, you've got no more vaginal dryness. Those two things alone can make women happy, but what they don't realize is you got that estrogen on board, you have less risk of Alzheimer's, you've got less risk of osteoporosis in some cases, depending on age, for menopause and type of preparation, you can actually reverse osteoporosis. So it depends on the type of estrogen and the amount and things like that. If you start it soon enough after menopause, this is called the critical timing hypothesis, you've got cardio protection. You're talking about like heart disease is the number one killer of women. So, and after menopause, when we lose our estrogen, we have a very similar, if not the same, heart disease risk as men do. Mm-hmm. And men have more heart disease risk than women. So it's really a big deal. It's not just like, you know, let's get rid of hot flashes, let's get rid of vaginal dryness. Those things are great. To me, I see those as side benefits. I also believe that having hormones balance with BHRT, you know, on or after menopause, actually helps women stay thinner as well. So I think all women right now are going to be like going to their doctor on that one thing alone. It'll help you be thinner. You still have to put in the work. You still have to sleep. You still have to do the self-care. You still have to eat good. You still have to, you know, stay low carb if you're menopausal. But estrogen helps you maintain insulin sensitivity. And it just overall is easier to maintain a healthy weight postmenopausally. So
I'm so glad you mentioned that and talked about it. Now, I know a lot of women, they are prescribed just progesterone. So can you talk about how this can be an issue?
Yes. I don't know if you saw it. I literally spent almost 4 hours researching and writing a blog post. I haven't written a blog post in like a year.
Nice.
Now I know why. It literally took like almost 4 hours. Yes. Okay. Progesterone is over the counter in the US, and therefore, you know, it's very easy access, generally considered a very safe hormone. There are some thought that it can be a problem in breast cancer stimulatory, but I don't know a lot about that, but generally considered very safe. So women think, oh, let me just use progesterone, or they get a prescription from their doctor. And by the way, I'm actually really not a fan of women doing progesterone cream on their own. I think that they need a really smart, savvy medical professional, even though it's accessible and over the counter. Mm-hmm. The problem with progesterone is you create, if you use too much progesterone, it does work initially for some women. Okay. But here's the thing with progesterone. You need a receptor for it to be used. You need a progesterone receptor for your progesterone to have correct effects in the body. What creates that progesterone receptor is estrogen. Okay. So if you are in estrogen decline, again, so let me paint a picture. You're 48 or 49. You've got low progesterone. You've got lowish estrogen. You use progesterone cream. Maybe it works for 3 months. Maybe it works for 6 months. And then it just flat out stops working. That's because you don't have the appropriate receptors for progesterone. So, and then when progesterone doesn't have its appropriate receptors, it goes down something called the mineral corticoid pathway. It creates bloating. It can create so many problems. Progesterone can work initially, but eventually most women are going to need estrogen as well.
Awesome. Thank you for diving into that. Yeah. I know it's very much confusing. A lot of women, we aren't taught about what our hormones even are, how they fluctuate. We aren't taught about how they will change as we get older. No women know that it's natural to have a shorter cycle when you're older. So, right. I just wish we would get some education with this.
There's not a lot of body and hormone literacy out there. I agree. And there's not a lot of informed consent when it comes to, what hormones are and what they can do for you, going back to hormone therapy. So yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. I did write a really comprehensive blog post on why your progesterone cream is not working. I just did that today.
I'll link it in the description below. And then I want to hear your thoughts on birth control with menopausal women, because I still see it. I kid you not. Women still on birth control when they're like 50 years old.
Your questions show me that you're like so tuned in. I mean, these are amazing questions.
Thank you. I really try and get into the nitty gritty.
Yeah, no, this is pretty amazing. I can't tell you that's pretty impressive. I believe ACOG, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, say that women can be on their birth control until they're 55. That is insanity, okay? Remember what I said, the average age of menopause is 51. So let's just say a woman goes into menopause at 50 or 48, whatever, 51. She stays on her birth control, okay? If she has a uterus, right, if she hasn't had a hysterectomy, she will have a reliable monthly bleed with that placebo portion of the birth control pill. She will not know if she's in menopause, okay? All the while, her own hormones are completely depleted. You know, there's the issue with osteoporosis. Depending on the type of progestin in the birth control, there's, potential for blood clots. And she has just, I always say that like menopausal age, late stage perimenopausal women on birth control, the longer they stay on, they're just kicking the can down the road in terms of problems. So it's a real problem. I've seen it too. With my clients, I'm like, you have to come off eventually. Like, let's do it like now. Again, I'm talking to women that are in their 50s that are on birth control. I'm pretty amazed that you're seeing that as well. I thought I had the three clients that were still on birth control in their 50s.
Yeah, I do have a couple, and it's hard because as a dietitian, it's not my place to be like, okay, you should probably get off of it. I like to suggest things for my clients.
Yes. But
yeah, definitely I've seen it. And then when it comes down to them taking just estrogen, and not getting even a progesterone in their pill, then they're not even getting that progesterone they need. And then they're wondering why they're having these debilitating symptoms.
Yeah, absolutely. I just educate. To be honest with you, most of the women that come to me have like heard something I put out there. And I always tell people, like, I am educating you and you have to make the final decision and you have to bring it back to your doctor. And they say, well, my doctor won't help me. Then let's find another doctor.
Hire your doctor.
Yes. You know, you don't have to stay with that doctor. I sometimes even help my clients find other licensed professionals who can manage their hormones. But most of the women, by the time, you know, come to me, they're like, I want to get off birth control and I want to understand, you know, what I can do for hormone therapy and how I can support my body. But yes, we don't tell anyone. We gently guide and educate.
Yeah, the best way to do it. Well, thank you so much for coming on my podcast. It has been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to make sure all the links, there's going to be blog posts in the description below where people can find you and follow you. But tell me, where can my listeners find you, follow you, or work with you?
Oh, sweet. Thank you. So I am active on Instagram. I like to think I have a very like education forward.
Oh, it's awesome.
Thank you. So that's like Maria_C_wellness. I'm sure you'll put the link. I do actually have a program for health coaches, dietitians, nutritionists who want to understand the midlife hormone changes and interpret the Dutch test. So that's called Midlife Hormone Mastery. I'll give you the link for that as well. I would say that's about it. Just Instagram and that program. And then, you know, people can connect with me on Instagram and, you know, right now, currently I still am working with clients one-on-one and groups. So.
Awesome. Fabulous. I love that you use the Dutch test too. I'm the biggest fan of the Dutch. It is incredible. I love it so much.
It really is. Like I call it an empowerment tool for women.
It is, especially when women can't seem to connect how they're feeling and their symptoms, being able to see data and being able to see this is what is actually going wrong gives so much power to them.
Absolutely. And I mean, I still love blood testing too, used appropriately and interpreted appropriately, but Dutch testing just fills in a piece of that puzzle that is not there with blood testing.
I agree. Well, thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure. I'm really excited to have connected with you. You guys, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask. All the links are below, and we will catch up in my next episode.